And summing it up is that medical affairs are the ones to make sure that your decisions in the company are medically informed, procedurally literate, clinically relevant, financially viable, and can be reimbursed, but most importantly, are inherently safe for patients. That's essentially what medical affairs does.
Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Hello and welcome to Pemba On Demand. Today I am pleased to welcome Dr. John Prasik to Pemba On Demand. Dr. Prasik graduated from Pemba in 2015. He is currently serving in the role of Chief Medical Safety Officer and Global Senior Vice President for Olympus Corporation. John also serves as the President and Chair-Elect of the Board of Directors of the Medical Affairs Professional Society. John has had a very interesting career path that I am excited and thrilled for him to share with us today. So, John, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Norm, and thank you for the kind invitation.
Oh, you're welcome.
Looking forward to our conversation.
Me as well. I've been looking forward to this for quite a while now as we've planned this. So I thought maybe we could start out today by having you tell us a little bit about your current role and maybe share with us some of your responsibilities as Chief Medical Safety Officer for Olympus.
Absolutely. In this role, I lead three sub-functions: global medical safety, global medical affairs, and infection prevention and control. These three global teams ensure the safe and effective delivery of healthcare products and services to our patients globally. As a member of the medical and scientific affairs leadership teams, we will basically take all of the functions across Olympus, whether it be divisions, global functions, regions, to ensure that there is effective medical safety integration end-to-end across the product lifecycle of all the products we offer and all the therapeutic areas, which are currently nine, that we serve patients. So some of your listeners and Pemba alum may not be familiar with medical roles in industry. What exactly is medical safety? Medical safety is the science and practice of medical oversight in product risk detection, assessment, understanding, but most importantly, it's prevention for patient safety. Think of it as medical stewardship of the product. Infection prevention control, we're all familiar with infection prevention people that work in the hospital. In Europe, those may be physicians. Here in the United States, that's more commonly nurses or advanced practice providers. And infection prevention control really is the internal scientific expertise here at Olympus that has responsibilities for such areas as infectious disease, laboratory, and reprocessing science, not just for sterility in the OR, but for reprocessing at the pulmonary or the endoscopy or the urology suite, but all in service of patient safety. So those are the two main areas. And then we'll talk about medical affairs, I think, just coming up shortly.
Yeah, that sounds good. So one of the questions I had about the infectious disease portion of your role, let's say, is I know from my past experience as chief medical officer in hospitals, we really depended on the vendors to help educate and train our personnel on how to properly manage either the high-level disinfection or the sterilization process for some of the equipment. So are you in charge of the teams that actually go out and interface with frontline staff that are using your devices?
I'm in charge of the teams that provide the educational materials, that provide the scholarly and scientific thought leadership, whether that be at societies, World Federation of Hospitals, Sterilization Services, and things like that, but also the being able to help when there is a crisis to go to the centers and investigate what may be going on to provide our expertise, not just on really pertains to the products, but it could also pertain to the environment. It could pertain to water quality, things like that. we do have within the broader umbrella of medical and scientific affairs, we do have our professional education division, or ProfEd, that basically is responsible for training both the physicians, but also the reprocessing technicians that may be, or the sterilization technicians in the central core in the OR. So you see, it really takes a village, if you will, of different aspects of medical scientific affairs. We provide the infection prevention and control. And many of these people, just like you mentioned, Norm, they actually had those roles in hospitals mm-hmm. before. So when they are meeting with a hospital, it's usually a peer-to-peer type of relationship. But we also have scientists, microbiologists, data analytics people, and I also do have an infectious disease physician on the team as well.
Great. So how big of a team are you leading in all of those three functions that you described, the safety, the infectious disease? I'm sorry?
Yeah. So we're leading a team right now, infection prevention control globally, of about 30. With regards to our medical safety organization, that's about another 15. And we're now building our medical affairs up to 5 physicians that are across our 9 therapeutic areas. So overall, the broader organization of medical scientific affairs, now that would include the professional education, which is the component I talk about where we have our education centers all over the world, our health economics market access. Those are the health economists that help us understand coverage, coding, and reimbursement because hospitals and physicians need to get paid for the procedures. There's also clinical affairs and clinical research that is responsible for conducting the studies. Communicating that is our SCICOM or Scientific Communications Division. But like anything else, many medical device companies, medtech is the term, as well as pharmaceuticals, they do engage healthcare professionals or HCPs, physicians such as yourself, and then we have a contract and management for those aspects. All in all, you've seen one medical scientific affairs organization, you've seen one, but for the most part, we're smaller on the device side. Back when I was at Johnson & Johnson and here, around 500, but a typical pharmaceutical firm will have maybe 5,000 medical affairs. Mm. So it is almost tenfold difference, but then again, they're usually much larger in the way that they approach the organization. And medical affairs has been resident in pharma for nearly 35, 40 years, where perhaps maybe it's only 15 to 20 years on the device side.
Interesting. Well, you also are involved globally, obviously. How do you split your time between the U.S., between other countries, and how is your team deployed? Are they all based in the U.S., and then they virtually interact, or are they actually physically in the other countries that Olympus has business in?
No, my teams are physically domiciled all over the globe. So okay. I would say that the way our organization is structured, previously there was sort of a U.S. or the Americas, so that would be Canada, America, Central and South America, mm-hmm. be a European. Typically, most medtech and pharmaceutical firms refer to that as the four letters EMEA, Europe, Middle East, Africa, EMEA.
Okay.
And then there's Asia Pacific or APAC. So that's going to be China, South Pacific, Japan, New Zealand, Australia. My teams are located and domiciled in both Japan, Europe, as well as here in the Americas.
And how is it's not market share, but what, based on revenue or sales, how are those three areas different in terms of size? What percentage of the business comes from the Americas versus Asia, that type of thing?
For all medtech companies, the largest market is typically the Americas, typically. But that doesn't mean that it depends where you see it. What you're seeing right now is China's growing quite considerably. You also see certain markets such as India, Asia Pacific, depending upon which products and where things are and utilization. There's different healthcare systems around the world, particularly how things are reimbursed. But for all intents and purposes, the idea is that you do have to cover just about everything. And in the med tech world, it is predominantly CE mark, which is the regulatory clearance that a product receives for the EU. And a majority of the jurisdictions outside of the EU do require that CE mark. which is somewhat surprising for those of us that here in the United States, because we think of the regulatory clearance for most medical devices as the 510K. But the world is more CE mark centric than it is 510K centric.
So let's talk a little bit about the medical affairs piece of this. Mm-hmm. I know I wanted to come back to this because it, as you and I had talked, I learned an awful lot about medical affairs and I hadn't really understood it. But can you help the audience understand what exactly is involved in being a medical affairs person in a company like MedTech?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. At a very high level, we are the medical professionals that serve patients from inside the four walls of a pharmaceutical, biotech, or medtech company. What we are is medical affairs is made up of medical, scientific, as well as clinical experts focused on understanding unmet needs, helping patients and society achieve the maximum benefit from the technologies that we're developing. Because medical affairs is predominantly composed of clinicians or clinical experts that have had some experience practicing or conducting research in the healthcare arena, medical affairs is uniquely positioned to engage, number one, in peer-to-peer type dialogue and in-person engagements, address knowledge gaps, but more importantly, keeping our ear to the rail, so to speak, of understanding where is the market going? What is the therapeutic advancements? Where is treatment going to? And how are those spheres of influence and where healthcare is being developed? How are we understanding the trajectory that those healthcare professionals are taking? That being said, we're going to have conversations because, as we know, it's no longer just the physicians that make decisions. The stakeholder group is growing. It's now those that are responsible for patient access and access to care, whether that be at a health system level or that be at the insurance or payer level. Through this scientific exchange, and that's the key, this is not commercial in any way, shape, or form. This is purely scientific, medical, clinical exchange. We also generate proactive, independent insights that are consistent with the trends that are taking place. We want to document those so that we can then turn inward and have conversations to help educate our commercial colleagues, that is commercial, obviously, R&D colleagues, our quality assurance colleagues, as well as our regulatory affairs. Because it does take a group of expertise to help bring technology to market. And at beyond scientific exchange, we're basically sitting like now with the medical affairs and medical safety working together. We determine the benefit risk analysis and the safety of our products from the clinical perspective. In other words, in summing it up, is that medical affairs are the ones to make sure that your decisions in the company are medically informed, procedurally literate, clinically relevant, financially viable, and can be reimbursed, but most importantly, are inherently safe for patients. That's essentially what medical affairs does.
And you mentioned earlier that the medical affairs role in medtech companies was earlier in its development than in some of the pharmaceutical industries. Is that just a function of when medtech began, or is it an understanding that has grown into the industry as they've matured?
Actually, Norm, it's just the other way around. It started out in pharma earlier, and in pharma, it's because you have more scientists and physicians that are helped developing the pharmaceutical asset. It's a little bit later in medtech, simply because when you think of R&D in medtech, it's usually going to be R&D engineers, whether they be electrical engineers, now software and systems engineers, mechanical engineers, that type of thing. Overall, they depended upon, and the traditional model had been, as opposed to pharma, where you had in-house medical, there was engagements with outside clinicians and hospitals and health systems for those insights. Gradually, as things evolved and things became more complicated, they realized they needed in-house medical and clinical and health economics, just like they had seen on the pharma side, because the environment in which everybody is practicing and the complexity of the medical devices, whether it be navigation, whether it be robotics, whether it be now artificial intelligence and image recognition, all of that was becoming more complex. And that's something that really elevated, if you will, the ascension of medical affairs. If you think about a typical hospital, there's two pillars, it's medicine and surgery. typically in devices, it was R&D and commercial. Same thing for pharma. But what you're seeing is those two pillars are kind of moving aside, and the third pillar of medical scientific affairs is emerging as the third leg of the stool, so to speak, because the complexity of the devices and complexity of the pharmaceutical therapies are now much more advanced.
Are there, is a medical degree a prerequisite for being employed by a company as a medical affairs officer?
No, not at all. And we have people from a variety of other backgrounds that are very appropriate for these positions. For example, in pharmaceuticals, you're going to see quite a few of PharmDs. You may see PhDs in pharmacology. You may see chemists from medicinal chemistry that transition. But also you're going to see among devices, both physicians, assistants, as well as nurses and advanced practice nurses. For example, overall, I had to, in the medical safety arena, within medical devices, many of the device companies have had for many years nurses in these roles. So when I was building our medical safety organization, I actually created a nurse ladder, much like I did when I was in practice, so that I can attract people that are qualified at various levels of their career. But those who are at the lower levels of the career provide them with a career ascension and growth that they can stay within the company, but also expand their knowledge. This type of thing, no different than you see nursing ladders and magnet nursing programs in hospitals, they have proven to be a growing backbone, if I may, of the medical device and pharmaceutical industries.
Interesting. And are there particular backgrounds within clinical specialties for physicians or advanced nurse practitioners that lend themselves very well to this type of a transition into a role such as yours?
Absolutely. So for example, you're going to see in the pharmaceutical world, more likely people that with an internal medicine background, oncology, immunology, diabetes, metabolism, and endocrinology. On the medical device side, because these are more proceduralist, you're going to see the gastroenterologists, the interventional pulmonologists, urologists, as well as general surgeons, neurosurgeons, orthopedics, ENT. Okay, it's kind of broken down by medical therapeutic area, and that's where people are attracted. Now, on the same side, I do have in that nurse ladder, I have a nurse that has a cardiology background, OR background, pulmonary endoscopy background, and then also colonoscopy and GI endoscopy background. One of the more recent hires, although she has been in the industry for 21 years on the medical device and pharmaceutical side, she comes from a oncology background. So in one of the previous companies that she was working with was one of the medical device companies that makes infusion pumps. So infusion therapy is a mainstay of oncology, medical oncology, that is. So you see, much like in all of our clinical specialties, I think you're going to see that transfer over very nicely into industry, and perhaps unanticipatedly, the connections are, the transition is quite easy because you're still using the knowledge that you built upon over the decades while you were practicing.
Great. Thank you for explaining that. One of the questions that I just thought of as we were talking, we've heard a lot about, I would say, some failures or opportunities within the pharmaceutical industry where the research or the data that was being used to market the information turned out to have not necessarily maintained its scientific integrity. How do you as a leader in this area in the med tech space feel about that, number one? And do you find that at times your teams are facing pressure from the commercial side of the business?
Great question, and it's an age-old question. And the answer is that no, I've not felt pressure within the commercial side of the organization. It's the basic scientific principles that you adhere to. Who's going to be an author on the publication? Well, what have they contributed to the paper? There's guidelines out there for that. Typically, most companies, at least I can think of just about everyone that I know of, is that when it comes to embarking on a study, it is expected that you will publish, and you will publish regardless of what the results are, because that's the scientific integrity aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I think what the where things may go awry is when there is difficulties or there is perhaps inappropriate relationships between organizations and the physicians that perhaps are not the best suited to conduct the research. So for example, you're going to want people in medical centers that have the infrastructure, have the diversity of sites, whether they be geographically, whether they be smaller versus regional versus tertiary or quaternary referral centers. And also you want to make it so that these are not the people, and there is a strict healthcare compliance code and a whole division of most pharmaceutical and med tech companies called healthcare compliance, made up of specialist attorneys and investigators to ensure that we adhere to a variety of both the laws and regulations. But the idea is that you want to have an approach that is, if I can say, above reproach, because there is going to be huge decisions made about therapeutic effectiveness and safety and efficacy for these types of products, whether they be pharmaceutical or medical, med tech. What we're also seeing is a change now to taking it away from the traditional studies that may be required to bring a product to market, and now using the advantage of real-world evidence. Now, what do I mean by that? Is that real-world evidence is a very, very different type. It's a different type of way of conducting research. It leverages the substantial investments that were made by the health systems on the electronic medical record. Now, this is one of the actual benefits or dividends of those substantial investments, because you're getting to see the absolute use case of how the products are used in the real world by real world clinicians that do not necessarily have significant restrictions that a well-orchestrated industry-sponsored study may have. And it's like anything else. There are times and places for different types of evidence collection. Much like a smart mutual fund manager will have different investments pegged to perhaps different clients' ages and lifestyles and investment objectives, as a product gets launched and goes through its trajectory and then finally is sunsetted or obsoleted from the market, you use different types of evidence collection strategies. So what you've seen more recently, particularly as of 2017 and 2018 in Europe, is that the medical device world has now migrated much towards pharma, where you now need evidence for entry into market for your product. Can't just say that is equivalent or a predicate to a similar product elsewhere that's already marketed. You now have to have independent evidence. And more importantly, and this is taking a page out of the approach they use for rare and genetic disease, where you're not going to have large numbers of patients, but you will follow, and those are frequently pediatric patients, you may follow a cohort of patients for the next 3 decades. And that type of analysis does require real-world evidence. So it's the idea of not only getting into market, but staying in market, and every year, wash, rinse, repeat, updating your evidence that you have that your product is safe and effective, and the benefits certainly outweigh the risk. That is typically how products enter the market and stay in the market, and particularly that post-market surveillance of how things are behaving in the real world. That infrastructure and everything is now actually being used to bring products to market.
Great.
Long-winded answer, but that's essentially the complexity that we now see.
No, I appreciate that. There's so many facets to this, and it's very interesting to hear you explain it. I've never really been that involved with anyone who's worked in medical affairs, either on the pharma side or med tech. So I appreciate you taking time to help us understand it. I'm interested in how you're trained as a neurosurgeon. I'm interested in how you got involved in the medical technology arena and medical affairs.
Certainly. First of all, we use technology quite a bit in my specialty, whether the advanced technology is imaging, whether that's advanced magnification with microscopes or exoscopes, that is a magnified image that's placed upon a big screen, no different than a general surgeon doing laparoscopy. Then also with navigation, robotics, and now just got back from an annual neurosurgery meeting in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. Everything was AI. Everything with AI for not only how you're going to be doing the procedures, image recognition, tumor classification, liquid biopsies of blood and analyzing blood parameters before a patient is taken to surgery. We've been a specialty that has highly relied on technology to allow us to do things. That being said, my entry into it was actually through what I was doing when I was practicing. And of course, using the technology, but I didn't interface that much with the med tech companies. Where it started was that once I was practicing and building spine and brain institutes, I was involved with helping other hospitals do that. And some of the technologies were involved in those transitions. And that was sort of my entry. It wasn't that I had a deep relationship with one or two med tech companies. On the other hand, when I did make the transition into it, much of that knowledge that I had working in the hospitals and the healthcare arenas, value analysis committees and building things, that knowledge is very beneficial to industry once you're on the inside, because you understand who your customer is and how they make decisions. And I practiced in a cost-constrained Catholic or nonprofit healthcare my entire time. So we had to be good stewards of the money that we had, and we had to make choiceful decisions based on what evidence we were able to collect and what outcomes we were seeing for our devices. And we couldn't necessarily afford to buy the latest and greatest, but we did not necessarily lower the standard of care with those choices. We were being able to deliver what we needed to do with the budgets that we had. So that was sort of, it was a mix of both economics, but also really the practice and the technology.
So it sounds like in your role as a neurosurgeon, you moved into some leadership capacities and started help establishing the centers that you referred to, as well as serving on the value analysis committees and getting really engaged with the quality of the products that you were at the time purchasing or obtaining from the med tech side.
Yeah. Let me explore that a little bit, because when I was a practicing physician, I was a program architect architecting physical bricks and mortar spine and brain institutes. Now, Imagine the model for comprehensive cancer, medical radiation, surgical oncology. That, you know, those pillars, you can treat just about anything. But imagine this now spun towards adult neurosciences. So you have neurosurgery, neurology, interventional pain management, which is anesthesia, and then physical medicine and rehabilitation. You have those four specialties, and we were linking them together with nurse navigators, but we used cloud technology to essentially was maybe the forerunner of telehealth, where our patients were coming in from 2-3 hours away. We wanted to get a visit beforehand, and our nurse navigators would use technology to ask them questions and conduct, if you could say, a lazy boy or a recliner type interview with the patient from the comfort of their own home. But those technologies allowed us to proceed and understand what they were presenting with, what were their symptoms, what kind of studies had been done. And it was all branching algorithms. So you could end up saying, okay, this person is having what appears to be, and from the imaging, not a significant issue, as opposed to something that's having a cauda equina syndrome, which they're going to be referred to the emergency room emergently. That type of dependence upon technology to hold the care redesign together is where I probably got my start, because that was sort of the underpinnings of the collaborative care model that we were building. So part of it was based out of necessity. Part of it also was the technology that was enabling us to reimagine how we would be treating these patients from a collaborative approach.
So when you moved into medical affairs, was Olympus the first company that you worked for in the med tech industry, and then you kind of grew your career internally, or have you worked for other organizations as well?
No, I had worked for other organizations. My first job in 2016, the year after PEMBA, was with Johnson & Johnson. I transitioned in, and most physicians usually transition into industry starting in their own specialty. So I ended up transitioning to Johnson & Johnson's DePue Synthes, that is the orthopedic company, and spine, which is part done by neurosurgeons, part done by orthopedic surgeons, depending on where you are. That was my own specialty. So that was the easiest transition. So I transitioned into Johnson & Johnson as a medical director, individual contributor for the innovation pipeline. So I was responsible for providing the medical insights to the engineers that were developing all of our new products. There was another medical team that was managing the products that were currently in the market in the field. After 18 months, the person that recruited me, he retired, and now I had a leadership role for both the, what we'd say, pipeline, as well as the portfolio. Some organizations today call that chief medical officer of the specialty. Johnson & Johnson called it franchise medical leader. Then shortly after that, as I mentioned earlier in the call, that we were facing a situation with Europe changed the medical device regulation, going from the medical device directive to the new regulation that required evidence. And then there was a change in a lot of the med tech companies to bring medical affairs, preclinical research. So that's anything from engineering benchtop testing to petri dish, small animal, large animal, cadaver, as well as what we call ethnography, which is time and motion studies in, let's say, an operating room or endoscopy suite. And then that's all preclinical. And then there's a separate section for clinical research where you're actually studying your products and their outcomes, typically functional clinical outcomes of those products in patients. Bringing medical, preclinical, and clinical together was a strategy to help it more effectively address the challenge that the med tech companies were facing of now having to have evidence to enter and stay within the market. After doing that, so in other words, it was pure medical affairs for the first 3 years, a little bit of a shift to the left to preclinical research and clinical research as well as medical affairs. And then about 3 years ago in 2021, I was recruited by Olympus to build their medical safety organization. So now we're taking a little bit of a click to the right in the other direction, away from clinical, more towards medical safety. Again, the idea here is to build experiences across the different domains of the broader medical scientific affairs so that you understand and can be a more effective leader. And that's another aspect that PEMBA helped considerably as you grow your leadership capabilities, not just within one organization, but across multiple organizations and across multiple therapeutic areas.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. For a physician who's interested in exploring a career in industry, such as medical affairs within medtech or pharmaceutical industry, what are the best ways for them to establish connections and to learn about opportunities within your industry?
Everybody can do it a couple different ways. There are people that have made the transition suddenly, like I did there, but I had some experience in working with companies. So I think there's a couple different pathways. One is be comfortable taking a leadership role within the practice environment that you have. Understand sort of the operational, strategic, as well as financial aspects of your organization that you're affiliated with. Step up for different roles, because that's one of the things that they're going to want to see. Yes, they're going to expect you to have the clinical knowledge, but they're also going to expect you to have some facility in understanding how business works, how finance, accounting, and really what they're looking for you to do is take your clinical knowledge and translate that into value for the business. That being said, is that that doesn't mean that we're involved in commercial activities, because I told you earlier that that's strictly prohibited from medical affairs, but understanding what different treatment opportunities there are, what is the product that's being developed, what is the unmet need that the product satisfies, what are the clinical benefits or regulatory claims, and here's where they really need you, is it's like, well, what type of evidence are we going to have to need in order to get that product into the country? That's the first evidentiary hurdle. On to the value analysis committee or the pharmacy and therapeutics committee, if depending if it's a device or drug, and then ultimately paid for by the payers. And as we know, the largest payer here in the United States is the federal government. But in many European countries, that's exactly who is. It's the governments that are going to be paying for these products and therapies. Understanding that and making sure that that is viable and can deliver both clinical as well as economic value is where things are right now. I think we're long past the days of the Me Too drugs or the Me Too devices. Nobody can afford it. They want clearly differentiated therapies that make a difference and also make a difference economically for the health systems that have to cover those populations of patients.
Great, thank
you. Now, having said, that means that some people will then transition to industry on a contractor, mm-hmm. Starting at the shallow end of the pool and then kind of wading to the deep end before they make the transition. Others will then continue to work part-time in other areas that lends itself to going into pharmaceuticals or medical device. I've hired multiple people out of the insurance industry where they were doing utilization review because some of the same skill sets, looking at information, rapidly assimilating clinical practice, making decisions, having conversations with peers. That's the types of skill set that you need in industry, and it's being able to lead with influence in a highly matrixed environment, much like you see in an insurance company or a health system. Those are the transferable skills that PEMBA helped us amplify that really make the transition into industry easier, because that's exactly what you're doing. Medical affairs is not going to have, hundreds of people beneath them all the time, like commercial or R&D will. I mean, those are the large legions, battalions, if I may use sort of a military analogy. We're small special forces, but highly effective at what we're trained at. That being said, some people continue to practice in certain specialties part-time, whereas others, like myself, that was one of the requirements when I transitioned, that you are going to cease practice because you are going to be so busy. And that being said, is that doesn't mean you are not going to think about these types of things, because I'm still licensed, I'm still board certified, and you have to carve out pathways to maintain that when you're not actively practicing.
Are you required to maintain your board certification?
Yes, and okay. I do. No. Now, why is that important, Norm? Well, shortly after graduating PEMBA, within 6 months, I was asked to weigh in and evaluate a business development deal, a merger and acquisition. Two other strategics were interested in this particular technology. It was invented by a surgeon, and he was brought it to market. It was already licensed, being used in the United States and elsewhere. And it was, he was ready to make an exit and sell the company. And basically, as he was at towards the end of his career, but he had been working on this for the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. One of the things that was important was that I wanted to take a look at the technology. Our teams, R&D and commercial, were going to be spending time at the factories where the products were made, speaking to the engineers that developed it. But more importantly, I wanted to see the product in use. Being able to have a license as well as insurance and board certification so that I could have visiting physician privileges for 2 days and scrub in with the surgeon to see the technology, not to do the case, not to treat the patient, but to observe the technology from within the operative field, that allowed us deep insights as to how the technology would work. And I have subsequently done that all over the world, being able to observe cases in Shanghai, China, or other aspects, because clinical practice is very, very different depending on where you are in the globe. That's why it's important that you still remain a licensed professional, board certified, even though you may not be practicing, because of those opportunities that you are going to have to step up sometimes, and those credentials are still required, even though you may not be actively treating patients.
Okay. What was one of the more significant changes in your professional career when you left clinical medicine behind? What did you find was maybe the most challenging for you to adjust to?
Two things. One is that we all begin by treating patients one patient at a time. When I was building the Spine and Brain Institutes, then you're using a team of nurses and the other healthcare professionals in the other specialties. What I really didn't anticipate is that as soon as you move into industry, you have an immediate impact on billions of patients every day. There's not a device or therapeutic pharmaceutical agent that medical affairs isn't involved with. We're involved. You think about all the companies where we're within and all the technologies all over the world, you immediately have global reach. I think the most significant change then is that you're going from being a leader of a team, maybe, whether it be your team in the OR, whether it be your clinical team, whether it was like me as a center director in the Spine and Brain Institute. Now you're challenged to grow in new ways as a leader. You're leading in a much larger organization. You're usually starting out as an individual contributor, but then building teams of diverse professionals, and you're having to lead through influence in a highly matrixed environment. That is not something that's intuitively easy or obvious to most physicians. Those of us that do go to business school like PEMBA really are the ones that perhaps self-selected. So there is some selection bias there because we enjoy that type of thing. But then you're growing yourself in being able to look to how different companies manage things and their sort of culture. You know, the whole strategy is eaten by culture. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. And then being able to navigate successfully those cultures, but also thinking about how are you going to grow as a profession. I think we all start out in our specialty, but I never thought that I also, the things that we were exposed to back in medical school, now I'm seeing those other therapeutic areas some 2 decades later, 3 decades later, and saying, my God, the advances that are in there is absolutely phenomenal. How am I going to keep up? How am I going to learn this stuff? And it's really easy. I'm hiring medical directors that are from those specialties, but also I'm interacting with the societies and they're like, well, you're the chief medical safety officer for Olympus. Olympus is a significant player in the GI endoscopy. Would it make sense for you to join our GI organization so that you have access to all the educational materials, the conferences, the hands-on thing? That is sort of, it's like being a kid in a candy store all over again, Norm, because you're getting to see things that you hadn't seen in medical school. It's like, wow, this is pretty amazing. And they're more than happy to help because they're like interested a little bit and like, well, what exactly do you do in industry? But by the same token, how is it, some of the questions you're asking, how did it change your perspective on things? I think overall it's perhaps compared to maybe a decade ago where, you know, you're going over to the dark side, that type of thing. The dark side's pretty darn bright and there's lots of new grads now that want to have a portfolio career where they're spending some of their time in clinical practice, but some of the time developing new products in industry right out of medical school. I talk to multiple physicians each month, and some of them are the new grads looking to have that work-life balance, but their work-life balance between industry and practice, which that my generation, that wasn't really considered.
Yeah, I think that does sound very different than what what I saw when I was graduating from medical school and residency. It is. And if there was any challenge for us, I think it was for physicians who were getting an MD, PhD, they almost always were considering going into academic medicine, not so much into the industry aspect of things at those times. So that's absolutely, that's very interesting.
But I think you get the MD, MBAs now that are not, they're doing it while they're in medical school. I was just this past week at Georgetown University and had lunch with 3 MD, MBAs. Some of them are going into pharmaceuticals, some are going into practice, some are going into devices, others want to go and do public health at some point. Mm-hmm. There was an infectious person interested in infectious disease, they want a global public health role, so they'll be an MD, MBA, MPH at some time. I think they're already, the students are just thinking more broadly right now, I think perhaps maybe than when you and I graduated. And I think that's encouraging, actually. They're having an open mind. And it's actually encouraged, but you're also seeing a lot more programs now that accommodate this type of training.
Right, Right. Well, I want to talk a little bit about, you've mentioned the PEMBA program a few times, and I know you were enrolled in PEMBA and finished it in 2015, and then you transitioned, it sounds like, into your medical affairs work with Johnson & Johnson in 2016. When you went to PEMBA, was it specifically with the idea that you were going to be learning information and gaining insights into how to transition from clinical medicine into your medical affairs role? Is that why you went to PEMBA?
No. I think this is an interesting story, and everybody that we all know Kate actually. It was really Kate in one of her organizational leadership development courses that I was taking and a project that I was undertaking that really facilitated the pivot. I was okay. in Catholic health. I had built in my career at two different Catholic healthcare systems, two different spine and brain institutes. At the second one, I was the center director, so I was orchestrating everything. And I typically had what we call the dyad, D-Y-A-D model of an MBA and myself as the two running the Spine and Brain Institute. My person, Sherry, she was a nurse. She had run an OR of 30-some OR rooms. She had built two family practice freestanding centers, and she built two ambulatory surgery centers and got her MBA on the way. She was able to help me understand what I needed to, but by the same token, I was always kind of like, wait a minute, I don't want to be dependent upon someone like Sherry because I want to know it myself. And that was pretty much the fundamental first reason of why I wanted to pursue the MBA. Second reason is that although we did have and responsible for our own P&L, if I was to ascend further up into senior leadership in Catholic healthcare, there's no way they're going to do that without me probably having formal business. So I, a formal business training and background. It was assimilated through my dyad partner all these years, and I had the same thing at the first system that I was at, but I really wanted to do it on my own. So in a pure and simple way, I did it to buy myself a seat at the table of the broader, more senior leadership table within Catholic healthcare. What I didn't expect was it reset the table completely and I entered into industry. So where Kate and that particular project came into play was I said, I'm going to talk to 10 physicians, nurses, dentists, what have you, that had made the transition into industry. The year before, in 2014, I attended a meeting in Chicago called SEEK, S-E-A-K, Non-Clinical mm-hmm. Career Conference. 400 to 500 people show up every October, and it's a two-day weekend held at one of the hotels near O'Hare Airport, and you get to see all the different careers that are non-clinical careers. So that kind of sparked my, so I would like to, you know, as part of my leadership development, what do they know? What do they not know that they do know now? As a person on the outside looking in, what type of leadership that they gained while they were in practicing or in healthcare systems, and is it applicable to now that they're in industry? And I said, with PEMBA being a year long, I want to talk to 10. Norm, I ended up talking to nearly 55
wow.
in that short period of time. Pharmaceuticals, med tech, law firms that were interested in hiring a chief medical officer, data analytics firms, financial services, private equity, venture capital, the data analytics, insurance. Everybody had medical officers, even including, and I spoke to the chief medical officer of innovation for the Joint Commission.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the part that was interesting and the part that both Kate and I were surprised. Not a single one said no. Not a single one. And I asked for 20 minutes and everyone gave me an hour. Every single one. I'm like, why? And I asked them, I go, why isn't it? I go, it's really simple. So many years ago, XXX, I was in your shoes and I had a hard time finding somebody to talk to. Pay it forward. Once you're in transition, do the same thing. And I do. I talk to usually 2 to 3 physicians a month. Because that is what helped me understand the different roles. And when it was all said and done, I had spoken to 8 people from Johnson & Johnson. The last one was the chief medical officer, Rusty Segan, for the med tech side. He said, in 2 weeks, I want to talk to you. He goes, these are great questions, this type of thing. He goes, what are you going to do next year? And I said, maybe I'll build Spine and Brain Institute into the for-profit side, like Hospital Corporation of America. I spent my entire career in the Catholic side. He goes, I want to talk to you in 2 weeks. So he interviewed me. Next thing you know, I was on a plane flying to Boston, and it was one of those things that wasn't sure. My wife's, you know, was divided. She goes, go. You're going to hit yourself if you don't. You're going to hate yourself. Just go do it. Yeah, you've been doing all of this. This is a chance to really speak to them and meet with them. And I absolutely listened to her advice, went for the interview, and basically it went by the end of the day. They're basically like, okay, do you think that this would be of interest to you? I go, this would be of very interest because it's the innovation pipeline. Are you kidding me? I'm a spine surgeon. I'm going to get to build products that I've implemented. But I also thought in the back of my mind, I'm going to give it 5 years. If it doesn't work, I can always go back to practice. I never look back. And when they ask you the question, and this is the advice that I would give your listeners, is that, are you ready to make the transition? Your answer has to be immediate, and it has to be absolutely. And their response was, put your seatbelt on. We are going to take you for a ride. And they did for 5.5 years. And that particular person, the chief medical officer and the chief medical officer of the overall med tech, as well as the chief medical officer of that particular platform, they made sure that, and I don't think I left the building the first year. I was like an intern. I didn't even get the interface with the outside. I had 3 cadaver labs. I had engineers booked on my calendar, you know, 8-10 hours a day. But I really never left the facility that first year. I wanted to learn the regulatory, the legal, the engineering, the quality, all the different aspects that go into it. And it's much like being an intern. You don't have time to even breathe or eat. You're just so busy learning in a target-rich environment. And then as you gradually grow and grow, that was really the transition. And in the retrospect, when we look back, Kate and I, we never figured this project would have ever led to this. And we still don't know why, to be honest with you. But I think it was because they were excited to be talking to somebody that was asking these types of questions, I think.
Well, it sounds like you uncovered sort of a hidden aptitude, possibly. And also, as you said, you've been just an interest in trying to innovate and help a larger number of people than you could help in your individual role as a practitioner. And it sounds like that's been very fulfilling for you as you've spent time in this industry. It's really a fascinating story. And I don't know about you, but I find this over and over again as I talk to physicians on the podcast or I talk to physicians, that oftentimes the roads that we go down are really related to opportunities that come before us or just almost what seem to be random situations. And then we take advantage of them. We say, yes, absolutely. And it's amazing where those decisions take us in our career. I never would have anticipated when I started my medical career, I never would have anticipated ending up where I did.
No, and you just have to, you know, I think there's been studies done that shows that, okay, your first part of your career, you're mastering your craft. What's next? We've always had these sort of 3 to 5 year increments, whether it be undergrad, then medical school, then residency. So we're used to that what's next. Yeah. And we're programmed a little bit for that. So what you see, it's sort of that 10 to 15 year period piece of like, okay, I'm going to get involved in what's next. Either hospital, society, an entrepreneurial endeavor, something like that. And, you know, I see CMO in front of your name, Great Lakes Bay Health Centers. I mean, at some point you said, I want to grow beyond just what I'm doing. Not that I don't like it, because that's always the question. Well, did you not? No, I absolutely love it. And I wouldn't trade those experiences. But as you get older and as you get more experience in your career, I think you're ready for a next challenge. And I think right. What you're saying is that in the physicians that you've interviewed, simply saying yes is because we're hungry for that autodidactic learning, wanting to grow and wanting to expand. It keeps us nimble and young and agile, to be honest.
I agree. Yes, I agree. Yeah.
And challenged. We want to be challenged.
Yes. Yeah. Well, John, this has been great. We're kind of hitting the end of our time here, and I wish we had more time because I've just been fascinated by this. I looked at the clock a second ago. I'm like, whoa, I can't believe that it's been that long. This is a great discussion. I wonder if
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. I wonder if before we go, you could answer one last question. And I ask all of the Pemba grads this question, the alumni. What was your favorite memory or the favorite experience that you had at Pemba?
I think the favorite experience I had was the Chuck and Jody show, where Chuck Moon and Jody Crane took something that you kind of didn't really know about queuing theory and things like that, and we set up the makeshift emergency room in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. That was one of the most memorable experiences, I think. I also have to say that my OAP was, you know, it's an applied master's thesis in the words of Mike Stahl, and you're going out, and for me, I was not working for my health system. I was working for another health system. And I was thinking this is an academic exercise. This is a deliverable. This is essentially a master's thesis that's taking the shape and form of a business plan. What I didn't realize is with that particular healthcare system, they operationalized it and made an entire medical campus off of that OAP. And it was just all of a sudden, it was the epitomization of what Pemba really was. It is opening up. This is the world of business. These are the things that we don't normally study as physicians. And they gave us the keys to the kingdom, Norm. And it was a pass to understand other aspects, whether it had been our health system, another health system, industry. It gave us an understanding that, oh, there's a whole other world here. And I will say, in answer to your question, I did have, after a couple of years graduating, I was at a largest meeting in spine that we have here in the United States, North American Spine Society. Pemba had a booth, and Bruce Bain was at the booth. And I said, Bruce, let's walk the floor. Let's look at this meeting. And we were just for what it was. There's technology. There's the big med tech companies. And I go, now, here's where I'm going to take you to a different side of the meeting. I introduced him to a few of the folks at GE Capital that were doing the investment banking deals, because it's a 3-day meeting. It's all about science and the Wall Street folks and new product launches. On the third day, that's when all the private equity venture capital people, there's a whole meeting behind the meeting, and I took Bruce and exposed him to it, and he goes, this is fascinating. But to me and for all the other Pemba listeners, this is the man that taught us accounting, and here I'm getting to pay it back and show him something. Mm-hmm. It was like we're part of a special club. This is an amazing thing. And one of the people that got me into it, I'm able to share something that, look what you taught me. Look what I'm now part of.
Yeah.
It was just amazing, because, and I think that's the thing, we're part of the Pemba Mafia that absolutely thrives on helping each other and keeping that connectivity.
Yeah.
When it came time for me to hire somebody at Olympus 6 months ago, I put an announcement in the alumni newsletter. Mm-hmm. Now he was Dr. Matthew Young, urologist from Asheville, North Carolina, came to work with me on my medical affairs team. He is Pemba 2011. But it's just one of those things. We're ending up, what started as an education has turned into a family.
That's great. Those are great stories. And I appreciate you sharing those. So it's been great having you on the show. I hope that this won't be the last time that you come on Pemba On Demand, because I just have a feeling there's a lot more for you to share. So thank you.
My pleasure, Norm. Thanks for having me, and absolutely a pleasure, an absolute pleasure.
Thank you again for listening to Pemba On Demand. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website. That website again is tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from our listeners and hearing from any one of you that have any comments, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have. I'll add the link to the website in the show notes for today's show. Also, please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button in your favorite podcast player. We'd really appreciate it if you would add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library. I would also appreciate it if you would leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player and share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. The Pemba On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Each live stream is also recorded and released as a podcast. We also have gifts and content in addition to the content presented on the live streams. Episode 17 of the podcast will be airing on June 27th, 2024. This podcast will feature Dr. Kirk Pinto, a 2018 PEMBA alum. Kirk will be discussing burnout in corporate medicine, pitfalls and opportunities. Burnout and moral injury continues to plague us, plague physicians as we experience changes in our healthcare system. So please, I look forward to releasing that episode and look forward to giving you the opportunity to listen in and to watch. Episode 18, airing on July 11th, will feature Dr. Stephen Stack. Dr. Stack is currently the Commissioner of Health for the state of Kentucky and is also a PEMBA alum. Stephen will be providing us with his perspective on public health policy and the work he's focused in. Stephen will be providing us with his perspective on public health policy and the work he is currently focused on in his role. As I mentioned earlier, we do have monthly live streams. They are scheduled for the third Tuesday of each month. Our next live stream is scheduled for June 18th, 2024 at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time. We do not have a live stream in the month of December, so please remember that we're only doing 11 live streams per year. Please visit the YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PEMBAON-demand. It's all one word, no spaces. PEMBA On Demand with a hyphen between on and demand for the schedule of future live streams. And please subscribe to the channel as well, the YouTube channel, and click the notification bell to be notified of any of our upcoming live streams.